ago.
Right.
And like, as always, I certainly won't publish it without your permission, but why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So my name is Ryan. I'm 23. I love your videos a lot.
Oh, thanks.
I've been watching a lot of them actually. And so I guess just a little bit of background about myself. I'm in the filmmaking industry. So I started in high school and then I went to college for a couple of years and I actually dropped out because I got offered a full-time job doing exactly what I love.
Wow. So, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good deal. And my parents were great. They were fully supportive of me dropping college to go join full-time with someone I met on Craigslist.
you've got good parents.
Yeah. And it's where I work today. So it worked out. Basically I'm a producer for filmmaking, so I get to hear a lot of really interesting stories of people in nonprofits, people just all sorts of different walks of life. So I think it's a really it's a special place to work because you're just exposed to so many different people. So I really appreciate that part of it. And I guess the reason I got into your videos is because I grew up in a Christian household, right? My dad's actually a pastor. Okay. So pastor's kid.
Yep.
Presbyterian, PCA.
Okay.
So I grew up in the church and I grew up in Texas and I moved to Rhode Island, which is where I am now, when I was 10 years old. So.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it was...
it's a big difference between Texas and Rhode Island.
Yeah, and I move in the middle of fifth grade year, so you can imagine for a fifth grader.
Wow.
How that must have felt.
Those are very different cultures.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, I like it here better, to be honest, but... But, so anyways, Christianity was very cultural in Texas, and it was very much not in Rhode Island, as you can guess.
Yep.
So... Yeah, I kind of grew up in an environment as I started getting older where Christianity wasn't just this thing you say you are without getting a little pushback as a kid. So I kind of, I think like a lot of people, I was, you know, when you're growing up, you're way more influenced by what people think of you than what you're, you know, when you're 14, you don't care too much about what's the absolute truth. You just want to fit in. And so... Yeah, so I really never thought about this stuff, and I kind of stopped going to church, and I went to college, and I never really took the time to understand it. I always was just more concerned with what people thought than actually trying to understand the thing itself, for whatever reason. And the past few months, for whatever reason, I guess enough life experience, I just started to become interested in it again and actually learning about it. And I think there's a lot of presuppositions baked in around the idea of Christianity because of growing up in a place that maybe strawmans it a little bit. Mm-hmm. As would happen anywhere where it's not the dominant sort of worldview. Mm-hmm. So I never even tried to think about, are those insults true? Is that legit? And so I started reading a lot of C.S. Lewis and T. Wright, watching your videos. And I always kind of had that, the backdrop, right? Growing up as a pastor's son. Mm-hmm. Then I'd kind of start to be like, oh, okay, that's what that meant. But now it makes a lot of sense. I think it... all this stuff started stemming because I didn't really have any political views because my parents were conservative Republican and everybody I know is very, very liberal. Mm-hmm. So me being the people pleaser I am, I'm like, I don't want to upset anyone. So I'm just going to put my head in the ground and not pay attention to Trump or anything. And 3 months ago, I was like, okay, I should probably like know what's going on here. And I think trying to figure out the political stuff, I quickly realized that your worldview is foundational to, like, it's very arbitrary to sort of like pick and choose like a buffet, like where do you stand on any political issue, like abortion or taxes, or I started to get into scuffles with people. And then I'm like, I actually don't have any good reason for my position. And
honest young man.
Yeah.
Most people skip that acknowledgement.
I catch it a few times. I'm sure there's a lot of times I don't catch it. But yeah, and I think that I got caught in that trap that I think is really hard not to get caught in, that it's like you start to want to ally yourself with a moral camp, tribalism, you know, really into Jonathan Haidt. And I realized I started to be watching those like Ben Shapiro owns college student videos. I'm like, this is crazy. Why am I like, the fact that that interests me so much is a bad thing. Like, I don't want to be this type of person.
It's a pretty natural thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You, as people, we naturally want easy answers, black and white. And yeah, Jordan Peterson, all the intellectual dark web. And, yeah, that whole rabbit hole. I had no idea how deep it was when I started going down it, and, I landed on you, and here we are.
Here we are. Well, yeah. Do you have a list of stuff you want to talk about?
I do. Yeah. It's like where to start. There's so many topics we could talk about. It's like the nature of reality and politics and religion. I guess something that really interests me is worldview and the impact that has on your whole life, because your worldview is kind of like your operating system, and most people, you know, get theirs from their family, and you know, you don't know it's there, and it takes a lot of work to unpack it and realize, like, oh, there's all these different operating systems, which makes sense because people really disagree about stuff and it doesn't make sense. It's because they're just on a different paradigm. So, you know, I think I had a phase where I was kind of into, you know, I started to veer a little bit too much into the hyper-rational sense, mm-hmm. you know, like the, not atheism, but like the hyper-rational atheist type. Mm-hmm. I started learning about like psychological biases and investing and like all the different ways we get trapped. And I was like, there's like 100 of them. And I was trying to just like learn them like flashcards. And then I realized it was insane because it's interesting, but like, there's no way to like subvert our ability to get fooled all the time. Like, it's just who we are. So I think I kind of went on a lot of dead ends. I was into minimalism and, you know, just the idea of owning less was interesting to me and not being such a consumer. And I think I was almost on a tangent, like hitting at Christianity from these different things that were detached from it. Mm-hmm. You've heard of Francis Schaeffer, right? In his, How Should We Then Live? Mm-hmm. So I watched that series and,
what'd you think of it?
I thought it was good, really good. Mm-hmm. And especially for when it was made, like the 70s, mm-hmm. I was thinking, how on earth did they afford like a Christian group in the 70s? How did they make something so high end?
It was a huge movement. In fact, I was just in Australia, and my hosts were in Labrie, and it's been amazing to me how many conversation partners I've had over the last few months have connected through Labrie. So Francis yeah. Schaeffer was a very big deal in the 70s, and he had a pretty substantive impact on the culture and moved people like Charles Colson, who also became a pretty significant impact in certain areas in the culture. Controversial, of course, but it was a big deal. It was a very big deal.
What was it, Charles who?
Chuck Colson. He was a hatchet man for Richard Nixon, who was completely devoted to Richard Nixon and doing all kinds of things for the crooked president, and got caught and had to serve time. But what in that whole process had an experience of what in the 70s was very popular term from the Gospel of John, being born again. And there's this whole movement that happened in the 70s. Chuck Colson was an important figure. Jimmy Carter was too. This whole born again movement that happened in the church. And in Chuck Colson, he had been an Episcopalian, and then he had converted to this born again status. And his wife, who was also a Episcopalian, was like, what's the deal? I thought we were Christians. And Charles Colson says, no, I'm really, really a Christian now. And I talk about that a little bit in my God One, God Two stuff. But Francis Schaeffer was a pretty substantive individual.
Mm. Yeah, his scope of work was pretty big, it looks like.
He impacted a lot of people.
Mm. And I think that his what he was most helpful for is helping me sort of see worldview as this very, see it like an operating system, see it for what it is. Because I think that the natural current, if you're not trying to sort of see outside of your worldview, is just to be whatever is popular in your geographic cultural place where you are. So it's very hard to see outside of that.
It
impacts all of your life, right? Like the type of job you work, the friends you have, you know, the person you marry, if you do marry, and kids and everything. So
that's right.
I mean, I've always been sort of, you know, I work in like project management, right? Because I'm an OCD planner person, and calendars and budgets and colored tabs. And so that definitely translates to my life, right? Like I'm very, people laugh at me because I'm so focused on, I think, control, which is probably why I'm threatened by Christianity in some sense, because I'm very much love the feeling of like knowing what's going to happen when and how things are going to shape up. So that's kind of, where was I going with that?
Well, worldview, you watched Francis Schaeffer.
Yeah, Francis Schaeffer. Yeah, anyway, so I think that back to my control. My love of control in my life, I think, naturally led me to the dead end that, you know, said, ask the question, like, how are you gonna make a good decision about a wife or about a house or about, you know, all of what we'd probably consider the most important things, without at least knowing for sure if Christianity is if I believe it's true or not. I mean, I have enough people in my life that are credible, that are very, you know, my family, very, very smart people. Mm-hmm. So the straw man that people, you know, people say, oh, fundamentalists, like they're dumb.
Yeah.
That never rang for me at all, because like the people in my life that are like the most devout Christian,
yeah,
the most intelligent people I know by a long shot compared to most people I spend time with.
Yep.
So that little piece of evidence by itself made me say, okay, I can see the major impact that Christianity obviously has if someone says, I believe this. Mm-hmm. And I see that it's at least credible. And I see that I'm at a place in my life where I have to really try to figure out, despite the fact that it's sort of in me already because of my upbringing, I have to, as much as possible, try to get outside that and figure out, you know, do I think it's true? And am I going to jump?
Right. Well, this is what you should be doing at your stage of life. You're going to be making substantive decisions. Many of them have already been made, but you're going to be making more. And as you've noted, you can just make them on the spur of the moment, or you can try to establish some larger framework, which helps you actually begin to line them up and work them in a certain direction. That will give you a much more cohesive story, which will give you a much more cohesive life. So no, that's, you're doing exactly what you should be doing.
Mm. And that's where I struggle, because it's very utilitarian, right? It's like, it is a useful tool for me, but I feel like that's not the point of Christianity. The point isn't what's easy for me. So I get hung up on that, because I'm like, it is very convenient in that sense, but that makes me a little skeptical. Like, well, is this just really convenient for me?
Well, there's a difference between convenience and actually helpful. You know, convenience almost has the connotation of a shortcut. There's nothing shortcut-ish with respect to the significant demands that Christianity places on a person's life. So, just because it's useful doesn't mean it's bad. And in fact, something which is not useful at all, in a sense, there needs to be a stronger reason why you would do that which doesn't work. It's usually because it works on a bigger time frame or a bigger narrative arc. Mm. Now, in your case, of course, you've got the additional, I'd say, blessing, but also with a dark side of you're already well formed in this, and so there is an expedience to just sticking with the program. Doesn't mean it's unwise, because here's the difficulty that you face. You had 20 some years to live, 20 some years to look around. People have been working on these kinds of questions for thousands of years. You can't possibly, even if all you did night and day was simply try to read what everyone has written about this, you don't have enough time. And so actually what a good family and what a good culture offers its young people is a lot of wisdom and a place to begin. And just what, like I said, you're at the moment in your life where you're doing what you need to do right now, which is, all right, well, I just had all this assumed stuff delivered to me by my parents, who I can see are intelligent, credible, loving. You've been blessed with good parents. Okay, but you're working this transition now where it's no longer appropriate for your parents to be making decisions for you. You're going to have to make them yourself. And, you know, when it comes to choosing a spouse, well, there's a big one. You know, you're working a job right now, but there'll be more career transitions ahead of you and decisions you'll have to make. You do want a framework that is both useful, coherent, serious, and credible for all the decisions you're going to be making. The difficulty happens when people don't have a framework. And so what then happens is they actually do have a framework. It's an implicit framework. And then something just kind of pops out at them and they say, oh, I'll do that. And we watch people do this. And then they pick it. And then, you know, weeks or months or years later, they say, ooh, that was a bad idea. You've actually been given a framework that is credible, useful, and it's a great place to start. And so you've been greatly blessed, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to have decisions to make. And many of the decisions you do make, even the best ones you make, are going to lead to places you can't foresee. They might look disastrous, and then suddenly you're going to be leaning on bigger arcs of faith where you say, okay, I believe that all of these decisions that I made were faithful, but now here I'm in this difficulty. How do I regard that? So once you get into your 30s, 40s, and 50s, you'll be dealing with that. But you're doing exactly what you should do for your 20s.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I guess it's the contradiction between my understanding of what Christianity claims on you and your role as a Christian, right? That is to give yourself up, right? That's the act of faith.
That's right.
It's that you trust that this thing in history happened and this, and you are willing to give up your idea of control, which is, you know, I think especially scary to me.
And trust me, given enough time, yeah, it'll get rested out of your mind. You have very little control. Your health, you've been given physical, I mean, just looking at you, you've been given physical health. You know, you didn't choose that. You've been given wonderful parents. You didn't choose that. You've been given a cohesive tradition. You didn't choose that. You've been the blessed recipient of a whole lot of wonderful things. And, the more you will learn the limits of your control as you exert it and you find outcomes slipping through your fingers. Oh, it'll happen. There's no question about that. There's the good news.
I know in the back of my head, but a little voice still says no, but you really do have control.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You just keep listening to that little voice. Keep going there.
Yeah. And I've had this weird sensation, and people probably, I don't know if anyone can relate with this, but like my life has gone so stupidly well that I almost like, part of me is like, I almost wish something bad would happen to make me really understand. Cause in the back of my head, I'm like, this is not the world for 99% of people. Like I grew up, you know, good education, good parents. Supported, like the whole checklist, everything. Got a good job, and you know, I don't
you're deserve a lottery winner, baby.
Yeah.
Might and as I will enjoy it. It'll go wrong. Don't worry. It'll happen. It always does.
But I want to prepare myself before that happens.
Well, and that is in fact the serious question to ask. How can you prepare yourself? So, you know, I pastor a church with a significant number of older individuals. And one of the things that I see is that if people, in fact, have been preparing themselves, and I don't just mean saving their money and taking care of their health and all of those ways that we pay attention to, but preparing themselves emotionally, religiously, and spiritually, if I dare use that word, to because what happens is when you get into your later stages of life, right now your whole future is possibility, and that's wonderful. Well, as you go down, those possibilities narrow. I mean, it's already happening. You just can't see it. You know, I talked to Tim, who, you know, winds up in, you know, junior high, realizes if he didn't start violin in first grade, he'll never be a concert violinist. If you weren't a basketball star in sixth grade, you'll never be in the NBA. And I mean, a really good basketball star. And those things have already been limiting, but you just don't know it yet. As you get out into the world is going to look bigger, and you're going to say, wow, I didn't do this. Right with your college degree question, I didn't get that BA. At some point, someone's going to say, your BA. You say, oh, I didn't go to college to pursue this job. And they'll say, oh, okay, we're requiring a BA. So, I mean, these things will continue. So don't worry about finding limits and lack of control. They'll all find you.
That's true. That's a good, and I think that's a good segue too to the idea of, it's interesting how reluctant people are to talk about death, and we all kind of pretend like it's not going to happen. We all implicitly believe we're never going to die. And that's been a really fascinating topic to me. There's this book, there's a couple books actually I'm curious if you read. One is called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. Gawande, I think that's how you say it.
Sounds familiar. I don't think I've read it. I've read a lot of books, so sometimes I forget.
You got your little Kindle library search going on.
That's right. You just open up the Kindle library and, come on. Oh, there it is. Did I read this? It'll tell me if I own it. No, I don't own it. I haven't read it. Tell me about it.
So there's this interesting phenomenon, and I think this has some parallels that go, I think, a couple layers deep to the popular idea of control in our whole lives. And I think it is made obvious in death, right? It's like what's popular is that hospitals, people will pay exorbitant amounts of money for another few days. You know, when it's obvious somebody's going to die, we don't let go, right? Like even to ignoring the quality of that person, we keep hanging on for tens of thousands of dollars per day when they're in a coma, when they're in pain. And this whole book is sort of exploring this notion that's so prevalent, and it's like, why are we doing this, guys? Like, you know, it's not wanting to face the end, and it's having the technology available that almost tricks you into thinking, right? Like there's this faint hope when you have this medical technology, I think, that like a few more days, it almost represents like living forever, this hope in us. And it shows our ability to not come to terms with this. And his whole thing is he's a physician, and his sort of movement is around accepting death and making good, I don't want to say cost benefit analysis because that sounds cold, but but basically saying, okay, like what's my cutoff? And like some people would say, when I can't do something I enjoy, when I can't eat a bowl of ice cream and I can't talk to my grandkids, if that can't happen, then I don't want you to keep me hanging on at these exorbitant costs. The end is there. Like if this fundamental thing that gives my life meaning is gone, then I'm out, you know? Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's accepting. And I think that, you know, it drags on and it's just a denial of reality. And so that book was really interesting because it touches on, you know, healthcare costs. And I think what was most interesting to me is drilling down to the idea of control and what that represents, like culturally, like, what does that say? It's not like we're trying to engineer our way to immortality with, and we believe it, we buy it. And it's just, bizarre. And so I've always had this fascination with reading, books around death, because death, you know, if you read like kind of life coaching books that help you sort of plan out your life and chase goals and those type of books, they always, you know, have you imagine your funeral and imagine, you know, these visualization exercises, because the day that you die is sort of this really powerful reminder of how you should live. And like, it's amazing how clearly everything comes into focus, even by visualizing it briefly. Mm-hmm. You don't even think. You're like, oh, of course I should do this. Mm-hmm. Of course I shouldn't scream at someone in traffic. Of course I should say I love you to my mom. Like, it's just, but day to day, you push this aside because it's so far, and you just, yeah. So I'm interested always in being familiar with that, because I think that the more familiar you are with the, you know, I think regardless of even if Christianity is true, if there is anything after this life, I don't know. But I think that in either way, it's helpful to stay in touch with the reality of your death as much as you feel comfortable to do so, because it really does help you, just appreciate stuff. And there's this book, Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, and it's a palliative care nurse, and she just spends time with people as they die, and she talks to them. And I think Bronnie, Top 5 Regrets.
Bronnie Ware.
Yeah, she had a really popular article, and she turned it into a book. But
a book like that, it's really nasty to the publisher, because if you just, someone will list them for you on Google. So.
because people just post the full book.
Well, they just okay. What are the top five? Well, you can do it in 5 sentences.
Oh yeah.
I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not a life others expected me. This is the most common regret of all. Well, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. I wish that I had let myself be happier. That's interesting. What's interesting about that list is that they're very much a reflection of the current cultural values.
How so?
Well, you know, some of them are pretty reasonable, and others are. I think I wish I hadn't worked so hard. Yeah, that's pretty common. I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends, valuing friendship. David Brooks has a really fine book, the Road to Character, and he riffs off of a Jewish rabbi, I forget his name, talks about Adam 1 and Adam 2. I have God 1 and God 2. He has Adam 1 and Adam 2. One of the atoms are the resume virtues, and the other are the eulogy virtues.
Mm, I've heard that. I think maybe from you. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the eulogy virtues are the kinds of things that you tend to hear in eulogies. And when you, if you go to enough funerals, like I tend to, because I'm doing them, you will hear what kinds of things are valued by the community and what kind of things people have valued. They spent time, the personal relationships, these kinds of things, as opposed to he made so much money. Usually when money comes up at funerals, it's because they shared money.
Right.
Now they actually had to make money in order to share it, but because they shared money, they were generous with their time and with their money. They were generous in terms of their relationships. Wish I had let myself be happier. Boy, you could ponder on that one for a little while.
So interesting. Like it almost doesn't make any sense, but we get it, you know? Like,
Yeah. I wish the courage to live a life true to myself. That gets into the secret sacred self that's far more complicated than kind of the conventional wisdom Hallmark greeting card sentiments relay. But that number one is so laden with that. People are such part of being such highly social creatures is we're such mirrors to each other. And so that's where memes get going. And the process that we began talking, beginning this conversation with, you know, your own differentiation from someone who's 14, who's just trying to fit in, to someone who decides, I want to engage in a process where I take a, see, this gets so cliched too, where I, you know, engage in a process of examination where I will try to decide what is true rather than just what is popular.
Mm.
And then you begin to say, well, how would I engage in such a task? One of the problems is that it's very popular to say, I'm going to engage in what's true. So right away you have a
everybody says that. Who says I'm going to go for the false stuff?
That's right. Well, and that's where you get your, you know, your rightful pause at a utilitarian approach, because there is a lot that can be gained by following a crowd.
Mm. Yeah, there is.
And especially being either a little ahead or a little behind the crowd, right in the middle won't get you much, but a little ahead or a little behind can actually get you quite a bit. But, you know, the task of trying to understand what is true, that's an important task. And then you begin to go down, well, how would I encounter such truth? Is it reason? So that first regret, I wish part of the problem with these kinds of self-made lists too are that people take words off the shelf to attach to the experience that they're having. And what we see are the words they've taken off the shelf. Mm-hmm. And these words basically become memes and they keep getting passed around. Courage to live a life true to myself. Well, what really does that mean? True to myself.
Yeah, that's a very American, because then you ask, okay, like what, yourself right now, is that a self worth living? Might not be. I mean, certainly for the serial killers out there, we wouldn't want to say be true to yourself. We'd say don't be true to yourself.
Exactly.
So there's this assumption that you're, I don't know who was it, Rousseau or whatever, that there's this assumption that like your base self is the best self and should be. Society just gets in the way and. Yeah, I mean, that's just plainly stupid, right? So,
and yourself when? My six-month-old self? Do I want to live in a diaper and basic sustenance? Well, at some point, that might return to me. That I'd like to not, you know, that's, I don't think that's my best self. So which self is it? I mean, this is far more difficult than we like to politely pass off to each other.
I think maybe it's a way people use, like you said, people pull words off the shelf to maybe try to ascribe communication to something, but I think it's almost like another way of saying be honest, be true about your feelings, I think being true to yourself, to play devil's advocate for that position, I think that's probably referring more to even if you're wrong, being honest about what everything in your life has, you know, if all of your experience leads you to believe that like something's not right or something's wrong, and you decide to stifle that feeling, even if it ended up being right in the absolute sense, it's the notion of being just like fake or
inauthentic.
Inauthentic.
We might, in fact, say do what's expedient or do what's meaningful, not what's expedient. Mm-hmm. I mean, when Peterson put that line together, it's a lot of work, and there's a lot in there, because I think Peterson is right that meaning is kind of an internal compass, that it's not infallible, but it's better than whim. And it's certainly better than expedience. And so if we were to rewrite that first one, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life of meaning rather than of expedience, because usually what others expect of me is pretty expedient, because most of the real friction we're going to get is from others. So, but the fact that people will regrets of the dying, there's also something rather interesting about, well, what stage are they in their dying? Sometimes people can be pretty profound when they're dying. Sometimes people can be pretty not terribly profound, and they're just functioning out of the limiting capacities that the process of dying involves. So it's tough stuff.
Yeah. I think that and obviously the book provides way more context to answer your question, right? Like,
no, absolutely.
Yeah. Which is why I think it's, of course, you know, a much more, I would encourage anyone who sees the list to not go through like a BuzzFeed list and actually hear the narrative, to learn about the people. And, so I think that the bottom line is thinking about death is actually a good thing, you know?
Yeah, I agree. It will focus you, and that's hence the midlife crisis. You know, someone more at my age, they say, "Oh crap, I'm on the downslope. Yeah. I'm losing my hair, my blood pressure's going up. I better get that red sports car." And
you're going to get a
yellow sports car. People do. The cliches develop for reasons.
Yep. And everybody thinks they're not going to be that cliche until.
That's right.
Yeah. I guess what I'd kind of like to go back to is Christianity. I'll tell you my plan and let me know what you think of my plan. So
cool.
Brass tacks. So I know that if I get to the point where deepest core of me believes it's true and it's something I want to align my life with, right, it's going to have big consequences for my decision-making. And I know it's going to require full, you know, it's not like a cultural thing. It's like, no, I'm not going to be a Christmas and Easter thing. If I'm going to go, I'm going to go because I believe it's true, not because it's social club or whatever. So there's that. And there's, you know, having credible people in my life. And, you know, I think coming to a yes or no on Christianity would solve solve a few things. It would help with political views, help to understand. I think it just, like, your worldview unlocks so many things that can't be unlocked before you figure out your worldview. Mm-hmm. I think realizing that materialism is a default in the U.S. right now, and it has its own presuppositions that are non-demonstrable. So realizing that is great, because it's like, okay, cool. There's like, you know, there's five or six choices. It's like materialism and I guess you could say theism, pantheism, or monotheism. So it's great because it's like, okay, well, the one I've been kind of operating off of a little bit consciously, materialism, is it's on the same playing field. So at that point, it's like, well, let's just look at all of them. So very quickly, when you get into Christianity, you have to start to, you say, okay, here's this thing that's really popular, and it's in our culture everywhere, and it's just seeped into everything. And a lot of the ways that we think are founded by this. So we're like, we're in it. Okay, how do we know if it's true? Well, we know that there's not going to be some like intellectual proof that we can do that's going to say like, I figured it out. Here's my work. God is real. Yeah, I've proven it. We know that's not possible. We know there's no end to that search, right? So we kind of start with those presuppositions, and we know it's going to be very hard to parse apart the culture from the, I guess, the true canon, right? And my understanding is that the manuscripts of in the Old and the New Testament are the closest standard to which we can measure against reality to determine if the whole belief is true, right? It's like, it's very easy to get caught up in different denominations and looking and being like, oh, what issues does this church support? And what are the fractures between denominations, and what type of people are they? You know, crazy people who have their hands up and they're twirling around in church, or are they intellectual? And it just becomes so much of yourself is wrapped up in that search. Like you're shopping, you're saying, what do I want? What would be convenient for me? Which is the issue I had before with, you know, kind of with saying like, well, it works. And it's like, yeah, it works. That's the problem. Like, that's why it's so hard to parse it apart, because like the proclivity is to make yourself believe it because it works and it has something you want, right? It's like comfort in death, a sense of community, giving back, a framework to think about your life. Like those are all pretty, I mean, of course, in the short term, there's bad stuff, but I think anybody that grasps the Christian, the cost and benefits, let's say, it's a good deal, right? Outside of if it's true or not, like it's not a bad purchase, I would say, which is the issue.
How did it work out for those disciples of Jesus? Did they live long, sure, prosperous lives?
I'll just get yelled at on Twitter. That's about the worst thing that's
going to
happen to me. Yeah. Right. So I think that goes back to it. Like what do you use? Right. Like presumably you want to make an honest effort to understand if it's true. So it seems like the Bible is it, right? Is that, that's...
Well, let's narrow the focus. The Bible's a big book. Let's narrow the focus. If someone was coming up to you from another country where, and we'll try to limit the context, someone's coming to you from another country or one of your atheist friends and says, okay, you're a pastor's kid. Tell me what Christianity is. Mm-hmm. What would you say?
I would say that Christianity is the belief in a supernatural, all powerful God that was made manifest in human form in Jesus Christ and physically was resurrected, and in a historical event, not a metaphorical event, I think that, I mean, the resurrection is my understanding is the core, right? And, okay. And from the resurrection, ripple out. Like, without the resurrection, my understanding is it's not Christianity, right?
Okay. Well, what do Christians do?
I try to act like Christ.
Well, how did Christ act?
Good.
He acted good.
Yeah, he was a good guy.
He was a good guy.
What I hear, yeah.
But he was a first century, he lived in first century Judea under the occupation of the Romans. Mm-hmm. How does that impact you who lives in 2019 in Rhode Island? I mean, you're not going for water every day. You're not, you know, so what is, if you had to boil Christianity down to a behavior, what would it be? Muslims can do that. They have five pillars. They can tell you exactly these five things. If you want to be a Muslim, do these five things. Mm-hmm. How about a Christian? What do Christians do?
Selflessness, putting yourself before others.
Okay.
That, yeah. Do you mean like action or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because here's the thing. Obviously, depending on the assumptions of the person who's talking to you, there's a young man who grew up in an Islamic country who's been coming to my meetups. And one of the questions he had right away was, well, what do Christians do? And he could say, well, these are the five things that we do in our Islamic country. What do Christians do? And well, suddenly you might say, well, Christians go to church and they get baptized and they take communion. You could say that. You can say, well, you made a much more general Christians act selflessly. Now that's towards
totally.
I mean, you could go down to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, love your neighbor as yourself. Mm-hmm. The guy I visited in Australia just wrote a book, How Good is the Golden Rule? And he basically says that the Golden Rule is actually this place to start where you can begin to, okay, I'm going to start treating people the way they want to be treated. Oh, okay, that's a good thing. And you can find that in Confucius. You can find versions of it in the Old Testament. It's actually been a fairly popular idea. His argument is once you start practicing this, then suddenly things start get interesting. So the wino comes up to you and says, you know, I'm not going to lie to you. I want $10 for booze.
Mm-hmm.
How then you have to ask yourself, okay, I should treat him the way he would want to be treated. Well, he says he wants $10 for booze. He wants $10 for booze. I should give him 20. Yeah. But of course another part of you says, now wait a minute. What is our relationship like in our lives and where does this go? So, you know, it's interesting because the culture war will frame the Christian conversation in certain ways. Mm-hmm. They're not bad ways, but it's helpful to take a step back from the framing. And, you know, one person that you might think about reading on this might be Dallas Willard, who was a philosopher in University of Southern California. His favorite book, my favorite book of his, is The Divine Conspiracy. And he basically says, which was actually, it won't be controversial in your Reformed tradition, but it was controversial in his dispensational tradition, because he said, well, what Christians are, quite similar to what you just said, what Christians are people who act like Jesus. Oh, good. Or another way that Dallas Willard framed it was, what Christians are people who obey Jesus. You get that right from the Gospels. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. And you begin to say, okay, what are the commands of Jesus? Well, right there, when you get to that question, what are the commands of Jesus, things start getting funny. Well, the main commandment, love one another. Oh, okay. Love your neighbor as yourself. Okay. That starts getting hard. But then you look at some of the other things that Jesus says, and you begin to say, well, what are those things about? And so I think it's helpful where Willard kind of brings it all in and says, okay, well, what does it mean to be a Christian? Being a Christian means obeying the things that Jesus commanded. And of course you can go all over, what about things that Paul talked about? What about the things that Moses talked about? Well, we'll just leave all those things out for now and just start with Jesus and see where that goes. And then, you know, all the other stuff that you've been given by virtue of your tradition, they will all color and inform those questions about Jesus. But I think one of the, So here are some different ways to try on worldviews. One way, which is actually a fairly modernist way, is you kind of sit back, imagine you are removed, you're sitting with some kind of monarchical vision, looking in a blank space, and here you have Christianity, Islam, materialism, Hinduism, you know, all of these options that you are a consumer and you're choosing amongst these. A smart person would say, now wait a minute, the decision-making faculties that you have all been formed by a particular one of these things, so you can't be an impartial person. It's a good point. Then you might start and say, okay, well, another way to approach the question is to actually begin trying on these worldviews. What if I lived as if Jesus was who he said he was? What if I lived as if when Jesus said, you know, those who love me keep my commandments? And okay, so I'm going to, you know, we've got the whole Bible. I'm going to bring it all right down here. I'm going to say, what are the commands of Jesus? And then you say, okay, for the next week or month, and keep the time frame fairly short, I'm going to really focus on this, and I'm going to try to live what Jesus commands. I would dare bet in that, even though you've had this long history of living within a Christian context, your baseline position having begun in a Christian context, you will begin to learn things about the world and especially about yourself. It's like, I don't want to treat that person with love. I don't think they deserve love. And you might be right or you might be wrong, but suddenly now you've got a decision to make. And then you're going to do something in the world, and that you're going to get feedback from that. And that's then going to go into your noodle. And so that's, instead of taking this rather third person, distant, philosophical weighing of that which is true, that's one aspect of truth. Another aspect of truth, which is more lived in, would be, well, I'm going to do what this philosophy says. I'm going to see where it takes me. And I think Jesus is a good place to start. I wouldn't be a Christian minister if I didn't think so. But there's another way.
So, and it's funny you mention that, because that's, believe it or not, that's kind of what I did recently. I'm sure it's a point that's been made several times, but I think in a C.S. Lewis book, it might have just been Mere Christianity, but he's like, try it out. Like, what's the worst thing that's going to happen by trying to not be a crappy person, right? Like, there's like this perverse satisfaction in loving someone when you know that anybody reasonable would not love them. Like, and that's what's always fascinated me. It's like stopping to talk to the homeless person, or giving them a ride somewhere, or someone who's super annoying at work, but someone asks me, like, why are they here? Why are they? And trying to take that point of view, like, intellectually, like, well, you know, it's, there's not a lot of benefit, but, you know, it's nice. Like, that's it. It's nice. Like, that's really fascinating to me. And I think that's what has always kind of, being someone that's always, you know, very sensitive to what others think, I've always really appreciated treating others in a surprising way. Like, it's almost like this fun little hobby I have. Like, you just try these, like, random acts of kindness in public, and it's exhilarating, right? Like, paying for someone behind you at the drive-thru, right? Like, it's silly, but, like, your heart rate kind of goes up, and it's kind of, you know, it's fun. And that, to me, has always been the inroad to, when I think about it, I'm like, okay, that's a pretty Christian, it's probably to my upbringing, but so I think, to answer your question, I, to a certain extent, have tried that. I mean, I certainly haven't hit all the things or whatever, but as far as the themes, they're really attractive to me, and I know they really work.
Have any enemies?
Not that I know of. I was thinking about that. I'm like, is there anybody I really hate? And
No, it's, is there anybody that really hates you? That's what an enemy is.
Right. I don't think so, but probably.
Well, you'll some of those will come your way too.
Right, that's the hard part, loving the enemies.
Not just someone who wants to do you ill, but someone who has done you wrong.
Mm.
And, well, there's one of Jesus' commandments, which is quite a thing. It's quite a thing. We're about out of time. So any last minute stuff you wanted to get in here?
Let's see. Any last minute stuff? I guess just real quick. So, I mean, I think that the acting as if has been really helpful. And I think it's piqued my interest enough where I want to keep going. And back to my plan, it's like, I think it's just learning about the Bible seems like the best thing. Because, like, what else? Is that, outside of just trying to keep doing it, is that pretty much seem like a solid?
I think learning about the Bible is a great thing. I've never stopped trying to learn about the Bible. I just laugh because God will throw monkey wrenches into your plan, but I think he will bring you good through them. So that's just the delight of being young. So
yeah. the delight and agony sometimes.
That's right. Yeah, agony too. Yeah. They're both there. They're both there.
It's all good. But
well, yeah. I will send you this conversation, Ryan, and you can decide what you'd like us to do with it. And we'll take it from there. Does that sound good?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for chatting. Definitely going to book a spot again soon. So you'll see more of me.
Okay, Ryan. You take care.
Cool. See ya.
Bye-bye.